Did you want to continue on that point, or you?
No, I think that I think you have. I've heard this generalization many times, and I've talked with some of the civilians, Iranian civilians, and I think the feeling of, after the fact, the feeling was that yes, perhaps they should have spoken up more frequently.
Now, you mentioned General Tupanian earlier. Now, over the years, it's been argued, there's been debate over his role in arms sales, whether he personally profited from arms sales that he negotiated himself. When you were in Iran, did you learn anything that substantiated these charges or discredited these charges? Or
I've heard lots of people say make those allegations. Yeah. I've never seen anybody substantiate. In my discussions with him, I think he has maintained that was not the case, mm-hmm. and particularly that he preferred to go through the Pentagon to avoid that problem.
Yeah.
He did indicate that there were people who were agents, and that particularly in the Grumman case, he did not. He tried to have it written in the contract that there be no agent fees. That was, you know, aired on 60 Minutes and so on. So.
That's right. Did you ever hear any criticism of the Shah from the military leaders in your conversations with them? Do you have a sense they were basically loyal to the Shah, or they have ever have shown misgivings about him?
No, they never expressed those views to me. From time to time, they would suggest that during my audience that I might bring something up which would support their point of view. If I agreed with it, I did it.
Mm-hmm. Can you give any instances of that?
No. I just don't remember. Again, I think it goes back to the extent to which the Shah sought their views, or the extent to which he asked them questions and they answered them.
How much interaction was there between the Amish Mag staff and the civilian population of Iran? Was there much interaction, or was the interaction more or less confined to the Iranian military people?
Well, I think I'd put it in it. First of all, within the Iranian society, the Iranian military was pretty much removed from the civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
A completely separate chain of command. In most cases, the Shah dealt with the chiefs of the services, the chief SCS, and not to the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
Although there were certain things that the prime minister was involved. Same with the minister of war. The minister of war was not primarily concerned, except in terms of budgets and maybe the personnel. But the Shah dealt primarily with these now. Most of the officers lived, and some of the married NCOs lived in the civilian community. And those officers became friends with the civilians.
You're talking about Amish Mag?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So they weren't. They weren't isolated to that extent. In my own case, where their jobs involved their dealing with elements of the civilian community in terms of their particular job, that they were free to do that. I made a point of trying to deal with the civilians that I thought were appropriate, just to more or less indicate that in the United States that we were not in a separate environment, although many people here think that's the case.
Not a caste system.
Well, not only caste, but not only an isolated system, but if you're living on a military post and so on, you don't deal with it as much. I spent most of my time away from the military post. I guess, in general, the American community was pretty, most of their relationships there between the Army and MAG were with the American civilians. They had a high school, they had their own school, they had the churches that they attended were primarily Western churches. It was very difficult for the wives to get around Tehran on their own because there were problems of becoming involved in an accident, so they weren't encouraged to drive themselves, to drive cars themselves.
The Amish bag was.
Yeah. So there were tensions and difficulties for the wives in terms of being able to, they were closed in.
I guess the Arbitrary had social functions, receptors, and so forth from time to time.
Yeah.
Were they mostly military people invited? Or any military people invited? Or was it a mixture of?
A mixture, yeah. For example, I suppose, well, at least once a year, the Chief Army Mag would host a reception, say, New Year's Day, which the international community, ambassadors and so on, the American civilians, the Iranian key civilians, and also the key military were invited.
Mm-hmm. What about like in the... You said there were some staff officers who lived in civilian districts.
Well, I lived in a civilian district.
Yeah.
There, all of us did.
Yeah. You didn't have a compound, or
no? We had a billet for the enlisted men. I said earlier that the TAF was housed on the base, the Air Force base, but the bulk of the MAG enlisted personnel lived in a set of, I guess, two houses that were joined together in a compound, but they were right in the middle of a civilian population. Your biggest problem in terms of dealing and living and socializing with the Iranians was the language problem.
How many of your staff spoke Farsi? How many of the officers?
I would say that not more than, and I'm speaking fluently.
Yeah, we had language training back in the
States.
There
would be very few, maybe three or four.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
That was, I think, one of the biggest mistakes that we made in both the embassy and in Iran.
And in the MAG. And not requiring some kind of language training, or?
Not requiring, but not making it feasible.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned to you that I felt that it was as important for some of the key people, or certainly selected people, in the MAG to go to language school just as the attachés did. And that in the case of the seniors, that they should be there for 3 years, because you were there for a year before you had any idea of what the problems were, what the environment was.
So the officers had to depend upon the Iranians' ability to understand English for day-to-day work.
Most of their contacts, they did understand.
Uh-huh. Yes.
When you get down to the schools, for the infantry school, the artillery school, and so on, or get out where you have your field team, then even if you can speak the language, there are the cultural differences.
Mm-hmm.
And so this isn't clearly, you know, they don't all, you don't always communicate. Even though you talk with each other, you may not communicate. And if you're an American advisor and I'm an Iranian, I may be hesitant to tell you that I don't really quite understand what you're trying to tell me about how to do this or how to do that. So I always felt that what we needed was were advisors who had the ability to recognize that somewhere between the Iranian culture and the American culture, there was a major problem of how you communicated in providing advice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this takes a certain amount of training. You just don't send somebody who happened to be a battalion commander in Vietnam and he'd come home and send him out to Iran for a tour where things were relatively quiet, so to speak.
Uh-huh. Now, in one chapter of James Bill's book that I have looked at pretty thoroughly, he discusses that he suggests that one aspect of the U.S. government presence in Iran was the existence of a certain amount of rivalry between the various official U.S. organizations that were based there. For example, he suggests that there was a lack of coordination or cooperation between USIA and the embassy, or that there was some tension between the embassy and Armistice Mag, and that lack of cooperation or rivalry made it difficult for officials to do their jobs in Iran. Now he argues that, of course, that you met with the ambassador. He mentions that you met with the ambassador. The Armistice Mag chief generally met with the ambassador, and there was cooperation at that level, at the policymaking level, at the top level of both organizations. But he suggests that relations between the diplomats and military men generally were sometimes tense. There's a certain amount of distrust. How would you see the relationship between Armistice and the embassy?
I would put those comments, especially in a matter of personalities.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that there was an institutional problem, at least while I was there, between the ambassador and myself, or
the diplomats.
The diplomats. Again, out of personality.
Yeah.
There was one slot which was where there was a kind of a military, a political officer whose role was in terms of some of the military considerations.
Political military affairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And depending on who was in that job, he could become overly involved in trying to deal with MAG problems.
Do you recall who that was at the time when the embassy handled that?
I don't know what point that serves in trying to bring in the name.
No, just for the okay.
But there were two or three people there. But you know, we straightened this out. We worked it out, and so that if there were a problem, but basically I had colonels that dealt with the political military affairs officer.
Uh-huh.
And if there became a problem, then I would talk with the guy myself. I never had that problem.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and I don't think it was a major problem within the MAG. There might have been some incidents. As far as I was concerned, both of the ambassadors that I worked for supported our role up to the hill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a problem of my not getting support out of the embassy or anybody else. And I think I mentioned to you before, the role of an advisor is a somewhat different role than somebody in the embassy.
Yeah.
you're there as an advisor to the government, they've got to have some sense of confidence in you in terms of the advice you're providing. They have to feel that you have an interest in their well-being or in their developing an adequate armed force and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've read that from time to time, and maybe there were times when
later in the 70s, perhaps. Or,
yeah, but again, I would say, as a generalization, I don't think it's right. It could be right in terms of specific individuals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I read that there was one element of disagreement that occurred during the 70s, was that from time to time the embassy would ask Army Strategy Chief to provide information or intelligence on the various Iranian military officers that he and his subordinates would deal with, to get information on their backgrounds, their views, their abilities, sort of military intelligence information, and the embassy would make these requests for Tarmish Mag for information. And sometimes very often Armish Mag was reluctant to provide such information to the State Department, or I guess CIA for that matter. Were you asked for this kind of information when you were with Armish Mag? Information on the various military leaders in Iran, and the various branches of the armed services?
Oh, the yeah. Army attaché or the defense attaché used to go over and talk with me from time to time about something, but it was.
Yeah.
I think there was a clear understanding that we were not there as an intelligence agency.
Uh-huh.
And that there were limits to the extent to which we really should become involved in what the attaché's job was. He was recognized as what, let's say, sometimes he'd come and ask me questions about something in particular, and I didn't have any problem with dealing with that. They met with some of the Iranian military.
Embassy people.
Yeah, yeah, particularly the attachés.
Uh-huh.
Normally, the problem that you're referring to would be things that would be the responsible of the Army, Navy, or Air Force attaché, or the defense attaché. And I guess, you know, in general, you might say that any government would suspect that situation existed, that there would be that exchange of information, even if there weren't.
As a routine thing.
Yeah, I'm not talking necessarily about the Iranian government, I'm talking about any government. Even though I suppose the same way we would look upon somebody if we had advisors here.
But in general, you don't recall, in general, you were cooperative when information was requested,
I would say that there were very few instances where they felt it was necessary to come to me for something. And I wouldn't say I'd been particularly sensitive.
Did Armish Mag have its own intelligence, people who worked on intelligence issues? Did you have a staff or a division or a bureau that worked on intelligence?
We had a staff that were provided intelligence and advisory assistance to the J-2.
The J-2 was
Iranian J-2.
Okay. There was. Now you said that Armish Mag had individuals who worked with Iran in developing its own intelligence programs
in other words, how to carry out an intelligence function. Just as though you were going to school in terms of how you make estimates and all the various things that a J-2 in an American force would do as a member of a staff or of an S-2, as we would call it, in a smaller unit, or a G-2 in it, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we taught them those aspects of intelligence, is basic intelligence training.
In terms of military intelligence. Yeah.
Just as we trained ahead of logistics staff, our J-4 was a counterpart to the J-4 of the SCS staff, and we assisted in training them about the logistic functions and staff functions of the J-4. Mm-hmm. This was not specifically in terms of trying to teach them intelligence issues, how to deal with the specific intelligence issues in the day-to-day activities of the command in terms of gathering intelligence on individuals or what have you.
More organizational.
Yeah.
How to organize them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when did you leave Iran? When did you leave the other country?
Right around the end of September 1971.
Okay. Did you retire from the military at that point, or?
I retired en route home.
Now, you told me a few weeks ago that when you retired, you started to do work for the Stanford Research Institute, for the SRA, as it's called. What did this work involve?
I became a consultant to SRI in the spring of 72. To the Strategic Studies Center, which was primarily concerned with strategic and political military issues worldwide.
Are they based? They're based in Washington.
Yes. Yeah. That center continued until 3 or 4 years ago. I remained on that at SRI. And even to the present, the last 3 or 4 years I've been working on, particularly on problems of taking a look at the year 2000 and shortly thereafter concerning the political, military, strategic environment that affects U.S. forces.
Now, in your work that you did for the SRA in the 70s, did you do any work that involved the Persian Gulf or Iran specifically?
Well, we did. I was involved in a number of projects that involved U.S. interest in the Middle East, which would involve, again, these were strategic studies, political military studies, which were being done primarily for either in-house research or for government agencies, U.S. government agencies.
Pentagon, for example? Or?
Pentagon, primarily. Which dealt with our interest in the Middle East, the role of the Middle East in our global concern. Primarily, we were involved with issues dealing with NATO, nuclear strategic weapons, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Some of the work you were doing, continuing from your NATO work that you were doing in the 50s and early 60s.
Yes.
Yeah. Drawing up on that kind of background. Who did you work with, in the terms of the studies in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf area, who did you work with preparing these studies?
What do you mean, who did I work with?
Did you do it on your own, or were you working as a part of a committee or a study group? Or?
Primarily as part of a committee,
uh-huh.
Study group. And it varied people there. In most cases, the boss of the office, the head of the office, was Richard Foster, who was the director of the center. Mm-hmm. And then there were different teams that I worked with. In other words, different individuals as a particular study group or team.
Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned earlier that some of the issues that you dealt with at SRI included what kind of national interest the U.S. had in the Middle East.
Yeah.
How did the question of Iranian oil fit into the conceptualizations that you, how did the question of Iranian oil fit into the ideas of national interest that you
were defining? Well, I think it fit in with a generally accepted view that we are, have been, and depending on the demand, dependent on Gulf oil. And that Iran is one of the major producers was an important factor in it.
To what extent did your studies assume that Iran was also sort of a buffer between, I guess, Soviet Union and oil, well, the oil of Saudi Arabia as well?
I think the studies all generally indicated the importance of Iran geographically, and because of its size, population, and so on, was an important strategic factor.
But the extent you worked on Iran, it was always in the context of the region as a whole, not, you didn't do individuals, you didn't do specific studies on Iran as such.
One study in preparation for SI, it's an in-house study for SRI itself, on for the Iran in the 1980s in terms of looking at the issues that would be, that might come up in connection with the conflict. But most of the, I don't remember being involved in any particular study relating solely to Iran, except in connection with the 1980s. The rest of them were in the context of the Middle East, the Gulf, and what have you.
Okay.
And the element of the twin pillar concept, and so on.
This conference you did on Iran in the 1980s, did you help organize it?
I worked on behalf of SRI. I worked with the person that headed the Iranian Institute for International Economic and Political Affairs. His name, Abbas Amiri. He was then the head of their think tank.
What kind of issues does this conference center on?
Well, it dealt with all of the major factors which we thought would affect U.S.-Iranian relationships in the 80s, what Iran foreign policy problems were, what its role in the area, what U.S. concerns were in terms of the global relationship, you know, the global environment, the U.S.-Soviet relationship.
Who were some of the speakers of the conference?
Most of them were top government people.
U.S. and Iran?
Well, I included Tony, I have to think of the name of the, well, for example, Musigar, they used to be IMF, was one of the leading, the Iranian delegate to the IMF, the head of their energy program, the oil program. So you had the problems dealing with the economy. They picked some of their key people to come over and present papers. We picked, Jim Bill was one of the participants on the panel dealing with the social and political affairs. He was an Iranian, an American commentator or discussant on the Iranian paper.
That meeting was held in Tehran, or?
I'm sorry?
The meeting was held in Iran?
No, he was here.
Oh,
he was down in Texas. As far as I know, after he finished his tour as on the Peace Corps, very early, he was only in Iran on visits every now and then.
The conference itself, though, it was
held here.
It was held in Washington.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
In October '77.
Just as things were starting to break up in Iran.
I went to a conference in Iran that this institute I mentioned held in 1975, which was primarily dealing with the Persian Gulf. And they had Americans, French, British, and so on.
Did you travel to Iran any other time since you left in 71? Besides that,
I went back there very briefly in the early 72, and then 75 was the only time.
I think when we first talked over the phone about our interview, you mentioned that the Shah at one point had requested that you stay on as a return as an advisor on military.
Specifically, the the chief of the head of the plant organization asked me if I would be willing to come back. I explained that under our laws that a regular officer could not work directly for a foreign government, and that there was the issue also arose whether or not if I worked for a private institution, but then the considerations regarding the fact that I had just left Iran, and whether or not this would present complications. And my position was that I did not want to take the job unless it was agreed by all concerned in the U.S. government, that was to the interest of the U.S. government, as well as to the Iranian government, and also that I would not interfere with the role of my successor. So in the end, because of all the complications, I decided that I did not want to pursue it.
Mm-hmm. What did they have in mind for you to do in terms of the plant organization's work?
Well, primarily in connection with the integrated communications program, which involved dealing with a consortium of Americans, Italians, Germans, and Japanese, from the point of view of the consortium, and then the Iranian government with the plant organization, the Ministry of PT&T, and I guess
PT&T standing for?
Well, the telephone. PT&T in European terms is Postal Telephone and Telegraph.
Oh, okay. His recent book, James Bull, makes interesting analysis. He concludes by arguing that the U.S. had sort of a twofold failure in Iran. There was a failure of intelligence in the sense that American officials did not really understand, did not perceive what was going on amongst the political and social movements that were opposed to the Shah. There was a failure of policy in the sense that the U.S. policymakers based their approach to Iran on the assumption that the Shah's position was more or less impregnable. To what extent would you disagree or agree with that overall assessment?
Well, I think, first of all, there was probably a recognition in fact when the white revolution, so-called, took place and the Shah's reforms, that he had antagonized both the clergy and the business, or the
Bazaar.
That there was concern even back in those times that the regime could easily be confronted with some internal problems. Then I think as time went on and the economy improved and the matter of the general social, there were social programs that were moving, there still wasn't any political development, and there the opposition was primarily in terms of some of the nationalist we felt that there should be more political participation, that there, that the role of the clergy was completely underestimated in those years leading up until the developments in the mid-70s. And then a number of incidents triggered off the street scenes and so on. So the extent to which, and then this is where I'm not sure that the facts are all correct or all the readings are all in, and that is the extent to which we influenced the role of the Shah during the days of the mobs in Tehran and so on in controlling. It was very clear to me in 77 and in the 76 period, if you will, that there was a need to start taking measures to provide for increased political participation. The attempt at the Rastaki Party was an example of where they thought that this might work. You could either, you know, if you didn't want to belong to the Rastaki Party, you didn't, you know, really didn't have a chance, you were disenfranchised and so on. But there was a recognition in that summer of 77 that there was a need to make some movement to increase the political participation as well as the social and economic measures. Once you start loosening the rein, it's very difficult to control such movements in any country. And this was exacerbated by the economic problems that arose because of the overheated economy. So I would say that that failure while probably a failure of intelligence, certainly with regard to the clergy, there was also the question, well, what does the United States do about it? And I think if you look back over what's going on in different countries where we've been involved with displacing a head of state, and the successor problem has been a very serious one. And many times you've ended up worse off than you were if you would have supported someone. So it's easy to sit back and say, you know, make these criticisms, but it's another thing to have to deal with them as a matter of reality. Now, on your other point, let's see, what was that? Intelligence was one and the other.
Well, see, that was a sort of general failure of policy in the sense that the U.S. assumed the Shah's position was more or less impregnable, and policy was based upon that assumption.
Well, I think that probably the Iranians, and the ones that I've talked with, all recognized that they were so concerned about the external threat that in those days from which particularly the economy was improving and so on, they did not recognize some of the threats. So, you know, the problem of the Mujahideen, there were those indications. There was the indication that the army could take control. Well, that it would be very hard to bring down the Shah to fall, primarily on the basis that the army was supporting. The question is, basically, the Shah did not want to resort to that force. So I think that our problems are far deeper and need to be taken in a longer term historical aspect. One, I think you have to look back at Iran before Reza Shah, the former Reza Shah. What Iran was like in that period, what all was accomplished up until 79, and a good deal was accomplished. 50s up to the 50s it was primarily dealt with security. In the 60s, they started moving into the economic problem, and the 80s is a time when they're going to have to deal with a social problem, and a political problem. On our own part, the United States became involved as a world power as a result of World War II, and up through, let's say, the 50s, we became involved in the Third World as well as to Europe, and primarily in because of our power and our ability to be able to support and assist others. When we began to recognize that we no longer could carry that load, then we moved into an entirely new dimension. I felt, for example, in Iran, that there was a tendency to think that we were dealing with a country that was the same as it had been when we had an economic mission there as well as a military mission, and that this was no longer the case. And again, in the 70s, with the advanced oil income, the Shah's desires to make the maximum use of the oil income, possibly the fact that he knew he had cancer, that he was trying to get all these things in place before he died in order to carry on the perpetuate the Pahlavi regime. And in a way, some of the agreements that we worked out, and some of the plans that he particularly tried to achieve in terms of trade, it becoming a major power, just overloaded the circuit. And I would assess the critical period, particularly in the decline of Iran, began around the mid-70s. They were overcommitted, they didn't realize it. The population, I think, generally, while there may have been some discontent and so on, the antagonisms arose out of these actions, which really just ignited the problems that arose out of the inflation, unemployment, and then there were, as I say, these series of incidents which in turn just fled from under the other. And finally, there were, I suppose, that there will always be the issue of whether, in the long run, able to save lives, and particularly the country, if more use had been made, more use of force. This is a question nobody can ever answer. Walter LeClaire wrote an article back here. I don't know if you know him.
I know who he is.
But he wrote an article on why the Shah failed. I've been meaning to pull it out and read it, but it's probably more insightful than good one. Again, I would agree with Bill on the point that our lack of understanding of the Iranian culture is a very important fact. And that this you don't achieve without lots of people who devote a considerable portion of their career to a particular country. For example, when I went to Tehran, I raised the question of taking some language training, and the point was made to me, as long as you can speak English and French, there's no need for you to spend your time on Farsi. So once I got there, I took some language training. I just didn't have time to immerse myself in it because the events just overwhelmed me.
I'm sorry. Mitchell, thanks very much for your time.